And I want to talk about something that I promised I would earlier in the program. I want you to shoot for being rejected 100 times a year. Now, you've really got less than half a year left, so you might not be able to pull it off this year. But for 2022, that should definitely be one of your New Year's resolutions. So why am I talking about this? Well, there's a little cool subscription service that I look at sometimes called Morning Brew, where they kind of give some interesting articles to start off your day with. And last month, there's a writer named Malia West who wrote about that sort of a phenomenon that was happening on Twitter at the time. And usually on Twitter, people will announce personal news, like, hey, I just got a new job. Oh, that's great. It's wonderful. But for some reason, last month, across all kinds of different industries, journalism, business, engineering, it doesn't matter, people actually started getting really real about their rejections, not their, you know, their wonderful new jobs that they got, but the times they got rejected for jobs. And people like Serena Golden, who works for the Washington Post, said, hey, if there's a media outlet that's in existence over the past 14 years, I whoever exists has turned me down multiple times because I applied for so many jobs and I got rejected. And so all kinds of people started chiming in on this, talking people in the media, all the rejection letters they got, authors. And so there's kind of a link in the story to a piece that was written a few years ago. It was a famous article that came out in 2016 by this writer named Kim Liao. And Kim Liao, she was writing for the Literary Hub website, this piece. And the article was called Why You Should Aim for 100 Rejections a Year. Now she's a writer. Now, it doesn't matter if you're a writer or not. You can. There's stuff that she puts in here that anybody, no matter what your job is, no matter what you're trying to do, maybe you want to go out on a date. I don't know. But you should aim for 100 rejections a year. It's not a bad thing. And so she started off the article by saying that in the previous year, she got rejected 43 times for pieces that she wrote. Literary magazines, she got rejected for fellowships that she applied to. And she said, I got rejected 43 times, and that was my best effort in quite a while. But I still fell far short of my goal. I wanted to be rejected 100 times that year. It's actually harder than it sounds to get rejected 100 times in a year. But it's also pretty gratifying, too. Where did she come up with this idea? Well, she visited a friend of hers who was a pretty successful writer. And she was like, oh, just having a great time. And this girl, Kim, was like, wow, I wish I could be like you because, you know, you're a beautiful writer. You seem to win everything. You've got the stones to apply for all these things. You get accepted for all these fellowships. You get published in these journals and your writing gets published. And man, I wish I could be like you. What's your secret? And so this other girl told her, well, collect rejections. That's my secret. Set rejection goals. I set a goal for 100 rejections a year. What? She said, well, look, if you're working that hard to get so many rejections, you're probably going to get a few yeses somewhere along the way too, right? And so Kim Liao said, wow, that piece of advice just struck a chord with her because we all have this ego within us that only wants to be accepted, that only wants to be loved, that only wants to be, you know, appreciated. And it's really tough to get rejection letters when you apply for a job, when you take the plunge and ask somebody out on a date, whatever it is that you're trying to do, maybe try to sell something if you're in sales and you get rejected. If you're in sales, you have to get used to being rejected. Hey, when we're sharing the faith with people, right? Guess what? People can reject us. And it does happen. Well, they rejected Jesus too, so don't feel bad. But so sometimes the response to this fear of rejection is not trying. And I was telling this to my daughter the other day. You know, I think it was Kobe Bryant who said this. Hey, I can accept failing. But the one thing I can't accept is not trying. I will not accept if you don't try something. You know, you got to try. You got to give it your all. If you fail, hey, it's a learning experience. But a lot of people don't even want to try because they're afraid of failure. So maybe something that it's kind of a little bit of mental jujitsu. No matter what you're trying to do, whether you're trying to, you know, evangelize, whether you're trying to, you know, apply for things, whatever, aim for rejection and make that your goal. You can never be disappointed in that. And it kind of takes some of the sting out of what can often be an exercise in futility. And I know a lot of you guys out there have had a tough time on the job market this past year with the pandemic. A lot of you probably have lost your jobs. You're looking for new ones. You've been displaced. All kinds of things have happened. So I know this is relevant to a lot of you listening out there. And so one of the things that was mentioned in the article by Kim Lau, this is again, really counterintuitive. There are a couple of authors, David Bales and Ted Orland. They wrote a book called Art and Fear. Art and Fear. And in the book, they talk about this ceramics class. And I mean, I remember when I was a kid, and we had this kind of ceramics class in school, and I made this like really cool ceramic mushroom. And then my sister accidentally broke it. I was devastated. It was so beautiful. Anyways, there was this ceramics class, and half of the students in the class were asked to do a lot of like a high volume of work, like make as many ceramics as you possibly can, a high quantity. The other half of the class were asked to produce work only of high quality. So if you wanted to get a good grade at the end of the term, the quantity group, the ones that were asked to make a lot of stuff, they would just take all their pottery and they would weigh it. So if you made 50 pounds worth of pots in your ceramics class, you would automatically get an A for just pure volume. The quality group, the other half of the class, was asked to make like awesome material. You only needed to turn in one project, one little ceramic pot, but it had to be perfect. It had to be perfect. Well, guess who had the highest quality ceramic pots? It actually wasn't the group that was asked to make only the best. The group that had the best ceramic pots were the ones that were told to make as many as they possibly could. Now, that doesn't seem to make sense, right? Because you think they'd be rushing it. You think they'd be, you know, kind of cutting corners or whatever the case may be, just trying to get them all out the door. But in actuality, the ones that were trying to produce more, they were continually practicing. The more they made, the better they got at it. They churned out all kinds of different work. They learned from their mistakes. The other half of the class, they were paralyzed because they were trying to make the perfect ceramic pot. And this is what happens to people sometimes. There's, you know, that saying, if it's worth doing poorly. That's a great saying for me because I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and sometimes I don't want to do something unless I can do it perfectly. Because we always hear this other saying, you know, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. So sometimes, like, you think, if I can't do this perfectly, I don't even want to try because I'm going to mess it up. But no, you can't do that. You've got to just get it out there and get it out there in the world. And yes, it might be torn to shreds, but guess what? This is where you learn. You get some feedback, and hey, that's what it's about. So we get like this sometimes. And again, Kim Lau in her article, she mentions this illustration of having writer's brain, and this could be anything. You don't have to be a writer. We all have this imaginary radio station in our head, and you don't have that because you are connected to a real radio station, Relevant Radio, and it's almost 200 locations all around the United States, real stations. But you might be listening through the app, the magic of the internet. You've got a real good radio station in your ear all the time, Relevant Radio. But some of us have an imaginary radio station in our heads too, right? In which one ear, and going in one ear, there's all kinds of, you know, thoughts like, yeah, you can do this. You can really be successful. And then there's in the other ear, there's another kind of DJ who's talking and he's saying, you can't do this. You're terrible. You're not going to make it. You're going to fail. And so there's this constant battle going on within us. And so we'd be much better off if we could just change the channel, you know, just turn the dial and stop thinking that rejection means failure. Stop thinking about that. And so the last thing here I'm going to share, and it's a really, really cool article. I'll send this to you, producer Lucas. You can get the link to this. I'll put it in the show notes. But Stephen King, who by all accounts is a very, very successful writer, he wasn't always that way. And by the way, I don't read Stephen King novels. I'm not into horror or any of that stuff. Chucky, you know, It, you know, whatever. I, 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 I'm not into that stuff. I don't watch the movies, The Stand, you know, all this TV show that's coming. I'm not into Stephen King stuff, but anybody knows this guy knows something about writing. He knows about the craft, but he wasn't always successful. And I remember hearing an interview with Stephen King in which he was talking about writing. It was actually John Grisham. You know, he's written all these legal thrillers like The Pelican Brief and all those, you know, they've all been turned into movies as well. John Grisham had this podcast. I think it's still out there. It's called Book Tour. I really enjoyed that. And he was interviewing all these different authors. He was at all these bookstores, and every bookstore that he went to, he'd do a podcast, and he would interview a famous author who lived in the area. So he did this interview with Stephen King. And Stephen King told this really funny story about when he got married to his wife, and they were like, he was a struggling writer. They really didn't have any money. I think he was teaching school at the time as well, if memory serves me correctly, in Maine. Christine Roussel, you can correct me on this if you're listening. She's from Maine. Anyways, so when Stephen King was getting married to his wife, his father-in-law was not too happy about this because he thought, there is no way this guy is going to be able to support my daughter. So for the first like little bit of their marriage, they lived in the same house as her parents. And he said the walls were paper thin. And I think her dad was like a military guy or something. So he was like really by the book. And he said that their bedroom was on the other side of Stephen King's bedroom and his wife. And so one night he heard his father-in-law talking to his wife, saying, you know, this guy is never going to make anything of himself. He's never going to be able to support our daughter. You know, he's a four-eyed freak or something like that. And so he's like, oh, this really hurt me. But then he said, you know what? Every time I bought that guy a Mercedes, I always thought of that conversation later on. You know, so I guess he bought him several Mercedes at some point. Yeah, I can provide for your daughter, but it wasn't always that way. It wasn't always that way. Stephen King, when he first started out, and he talks about this in his memoir called On Writing. And he said that when he was in high school, he started sending out fantasy stories, horror, science fiction to all these magazines, and they all got rejected. So every time he got a rejection letter, he would put it on a nail sticking out of his bedroom wall. And soon this stack of rejection slips grew into this huge, you know, it was like kitchen drapes or something like that, you know? And he reveled in it. He was like, okay, that one's done. Another story bites the dust. All right, I got to go back to the well again. And that didn't work. And so even guys as successful as Stephen King obviously had to start somewhere. And they got rejected a lot. So I think you should try. I think you should try whatever it is that you're trying to do. Don't be afraid of rejection. Because the more times you get rejected, the odds are at least sometimes you're going to get accepted. So try again. We fall down in the spiritual life. We get back up. We try again. And that's what we do. So I don't know if that's helpful for you, but I found that kind of an inspiring story. Producer Lucas, I am absolutely aghast that you haven't seen the movie Gladiator, first of all.
Yeah, no, I'm terrible with movies. I'm sorry. I was gonna say.
You know, you've probably been spending your time more productively, like reading books and learning about stuff, right?
Trying to. I just started Dante's Inferno.
Ooh.
Because September 14th, well, September 13th or September 14th, the date is a little bit controversial according to what scholars you look at, was the death of Dante, and that was 700 years ago.
That's right. Yep.
So I thought it would be cool to pick up his writing. It's, speaking of failure, it's the third time that I've tried reading it, because I tried twice before and I was just like, I'm having a difficult time getting through this. So we'll see if the third time's the charm. But
yeah, I'd be curious to see what your progress is going to be on that. And I commend you for giving that a shot. I've never read Dante. There were a ton of articles a few days ago. I thought about talking about it on the program, but I've never read Dante, so I didn't feel like it'd be authentic. Talking about Dante's Inferno and all the lessons we can learn from that. But it's obviously something that's captured the imagination throughout the centuries, and there's so much truth there. And yeah, and speaking of dates in September, one thing that you mentioned to me off the air when I was talking about St. Maurice and the Reverend Theodore Parker, who used that saint as an example, fighting against the evils of slavery, you said that Abraham Lincoln actually signed the Emancipation Proclamation on this date as well.
Yeah, so this is pretty cool. Part of me wonders if Abraham Lincoln did this on purpose, or if it was providential or what. But according to History.com, so the History Channel, on this date in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Wow. So I think that's pretty cool that he did that, and it happened to be on St. Maurice's feast day.
Yeah, that is really cool. I wonder if there is a connection. I'm sure people have written about that. That's pretty cool as well. So I enjoyed learning about St. Maurice. Again, it's an epic story. It should be a movie. It would be a blockbuster. It's got everything. And I also, you know, it was really interesting when we were talking earlier about the coat of arms of Pope Benedict, and it has that Moor on the coat of arms, but also those other two symbols that are on the coat of arms. Are people have been asking questions about that? What's up with the bear with the backpack? What is that all about? Well, I'll tell you. It's called St. Corbinian's Bear. St. Corbinian's Bear. Now, what is that all about? And again, when he was the Bishop of Munich, he also had the same coat of arms later as a cardinal, but it kind of got switched up a little bit when he became Pope. So let's talk about the bear. The bear comes from an old Bavarian legend. Of course, Pope Benedict hails from Bavaria. It's about St. Corbinian, who was the first bishop and the patron saint of the Diocese of Freising. And it's really cold there. It is freezing. I just thought of that. That's a bad pun. Anyways, so apparently St. Corbinian, when he was on his way to Rome, a bear attacked his horse and killed his horse. And St. Corbinian was like, I am so angry right now because I was going to ride that horse to Rome. And now you've kind of messed things up, bear. So St. Corbinian punished the bear by making him carry the saint's belongings the rest of the way to Rome. So he just kind of, you're going to be my mule, bear. And so he kind of threw the backpack over the bear and walked alongside the bear. And that probably turned a lot of heads when he walked into Rome with a bear.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I love that.
It's a cool story. So it's probably an apocryphal story, but Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, he said this in his memoirs called Milestones. He said, well, the bear symbolizes the beast that is tamed by the grace of God. And the pack that he is carrying, the backpack, symbolizes the weight of the episcopate. You know, being a bishop, that is a weighty burden. And, you know, God's gonna judge all of us, of course, for, you know, what we did with the gifts we've been given, stewardship, you know, time, talent, treasure. But obviously there is a weight to the office, and especially the office of the papacy, right? And he talked about that too. When he realized that he was going to be the next pope, and he did not want to be pope, you'd have to be insane to want to be pope. He just wanted to retire to Bavaria, write theology books. But when he realized, he said it was like the guillotine was falling on me. He saw the way the votes were going in the conclave, and he was like, oh my gosh, they're going to pick me. And he was absolutely like the crushing responsibility. That's why this little room where the popes get dressed before they come out, you know, on the balcony in St. Peter's Square, it's called the Room of Tears, I believe, where they actually put on the papal, you know, outfit, the white outfit and everything. And then they come out, it's called the Room of Tears because there's a huge responsibility. But he said he was like crushed by it for a moment, but then he felt the Lord saying, you know, I'm going to help you. I'm going to carry you. It's like, you know, Jesus reaching out his hand to Peter on the water, you know, lifting him out. You know, what you started to sink because you started to doubt. And so you've got to trust in me. I'm going to help you. And so he felt the Lord strengthening him. And I remember when he came out on the balcony, Lucas, he was just like waving his arms around like a little kid. Like it was really a joyful moment. I'll never forget that. And when he said, you know, and Mary, the mother of God, is on our side. She's on our side. And that is awesome too. She's on our side. And I'm on your side. I'm your friend, Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to the program today on Relevant Radio. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alog took your phone calls. We'll see you tomorrow. Timory's up next, followed by the Family Rosary. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.